Our first speaker is Hunter Frame, and the title of his presentation is Extraction and Activity Characterization of Urease from Selected Crop Residues.
Thank you very much. I'm Hunter Frame. I'm a PhD candidate at Virginia Tech under Dr. Mark Alley, and today I'm going to be talking about extraction of urease from crop residues and what impact that may have on nitrogen management in the future. So why extract urease? I have some pictures here of some no-till corn that's grown in Virginia. And in the southeast, no-till has become a bigger part of the production system over the past decade. And we know that ammonia volatilization losses are affected by the cover left on the ground. And we know that they're greater from residue covers than they are from bare soil or conventional tilled soils. So what we're looking at is this conversion of urea-based fertilizers that's catalyzed by the enzyme urease in soils and in plant residue, and it's converted to ammonia and looking at ammonia volatilization losses. And there's a couple different ways to manage ammonia volatilization losses from residues and from bare soil, and one is to coat urea in urease inhibitors, as well as you can also inject it or knife it in below the soil surface to reduce losses. But this enzyme is urease is what we're going to be looking at, and we were looking at how does this vary from different residue types. So is corn urease activity different from soybean urease activity? So the objectives of the study were to separate urease. Can we be successful in separating urease from corn and soybean residues, and with using sodium phosphate extracting solutions that have been described in previous research? And the second objective is to evaluate two methods of assaying the enzyme's activity and see if one method is better than the other, or what's the advantages, disadvantages of those methods. So what we did, we went to corn and soybean fields directly after harvest. So the combine had just gone through the field, and we collected a couple kilograms of residue. We air dried the residues, and then we ground the residues to pass a 1 millimeter sieve using a hammer mill, and then we sealed them in plastic bags for storage. Now we used two different types of extracting solutions, and I'll get into more why we had to switch to this modified extracting solution here in a minute. But the first extracting or initial extracting solution was a 25 millimolar sodium phosphate made from monobasic anhydrous sodium phosphate, 50 millimolar sodium chloride, 5 millimolar EDTA solution, and 0.1% by volume of 2 mercapta ethanol, and we buffer that around a pH of 7.5. The modified extracting solution, basically what we did is we increased the strength or increased the molarity of the sodium phosphate to 50 millimolar solution, but we used a mixture of the conjugate base, dibasic heptahydrate, and weak acid, monobasic anhydrous, to kind of give us more buffering capacity. And then all the other constituents in the extracting solutions remain the same. So I said we had a little bit of problem with the initial buffering of the first extracting solution. And what we found was that the corn residue dropped the pH to around 6.67 when we extracted the corn residue, and whereas soybeans was 7.1. I had a pH of 7.1. And this is important in enzyme activity because pH affects enzyme activity. And if you look in literature, 6.67 is about the minimum for urease activity. So we knew that wasn't going to be good in corn. So we modified the extracting solution, and this graph here is a titration curve of our different extracting solutions. The solid circles are the 25 millimolar buffer, and the crosses are 50 millimolar. And as you can see, the more acid you add, the greater the buffering capability of the modified solution. So that's the one that we're working with now, and that's the one we're going to continue to work with, because once we extracted the two types of residues, we found that corn had a pH of 6.92, whereas soybeans had a pH of 6.97. And we felt like those were better to make a comparison against each other in this study. So how we extracted urease, our extraction process. All the steps were carried out from 0 to 4 degrees Celsius, as best as we can control the temperature. We had a 1 to 10 ratio, 1 gram of plant material to 10 grams of extracting solution. And then we blended the extracting solution residue for 15 minutes in the blender that was pictured on two slides earlier. And once the material was blended, We then filtered material using a number one Wattman filter paper, and then the filtrate was then centrifuged at 15,000 G's for 30 minutes at 2 degrees Celsius. Supernatant was decanted and retained as what we call crude extract, which we're going to run assays on. And here we have soybean crude extract on the left with corn crude extract on the right. So how do we measure urease activity? Well, since we're soil fertility guys, we didn't have the technology in the lab until later we found out that one of the collaborating labs had the technology. But we used the Latchett flow injection colorimeter to measure ammonia production. And the initial urease assays, we used a 25 millimolar buffer of sodium phosphate buffer, and it was at 30 degrees C in the incubation chamber. And the two assays that we did was that for 24 hours just to see if we had activity initially, and then we measured every hour from 1 to 4 hours. The modified urease activities assays, we used a 50 millimolar buffer, but we used Fourier transform infrared spectroscopy. And I was working with a professor from BSE, Dr. Justin Barone, and he had this instrument in his lab. And this allows us to measure from 0 to 20 minutes, and we have 1 to 2 minute sampling intervals. And we use just a 1-to-1 ratio of 0.1 molar urea and 1 mil of crude extract. And we also incorporated jack bean urease that we had purchased in these assays. So what did we find? What we found were that in the initial assays that we did get urease activity in both from the corn and the soybean residues. However, the soybean residue the activity was much greater than in the corn residue. And in 24 hours, the soybean residue was able to convert all of the urea in to ammonia in within 24 hours. And here we have a table of the first initial assay, and we see when we just have urea alone and urease alone, that crude extract, we do not get any production of ammonia. But when we add the two together, we converted almost all the urea in to ammonia in that we had in solution. The second initial assays that we had used were, again, colorimetrically determined, but we measured 1 to 4 hours. And again, we see within 4 hours, the soybean crude extract converted almost 100% of the urea in to ammonia in our assay, whereas in the corn, only 3.5% of the urea in was converted to ammonia in this assay. So there's a big differential between soybean urease and corn urease in these initial assays. So this is the jack bean urease data from the FTIR, the infrared spectroscopy. And what we're looking at here, if we go back to that urease reaction, we're actually looking at the peaks produced by the bicarbonate molecule in this spectrophotometer. And we see the bicarbonate peak in most literature is around 1360 wave numbers. And here we have times from 0 times 0, 5 minutes, 11 minutes, 16 minutes, and 19 minutes. And we see that the bicarbonate peak is building steadily. And this shows that we have urease activity in this solution. And from this data, this is pretty new data, we can get enzyme kinetics and get the true kinetics of the enzyme and of our crude extracts. And here we have the soybean crude extract. And as you can see, we knew that soybean was a lot more active in these solutions than corn, so we expected to be able to see some activity. And again, we see at the 1362 wave number, or inverse centimeters, we have zero, no peak, and the peak is building for the bicarbonate in this study. Corn, this was very reassuring for us because we didn't know how this was going to shape up with the new extracting solution. But corn, again, showed no activity, even at a pH of 7 on the FTIR. We don't see any buildup of bicarbonate peak. And I didn't label the spectrum on here, but that is in no particular order from 0 to 20 increasing. That's just the inherent variation of the assay and the spectra from this study. But we see no bicarbonate peak really being produced at this same wave number. So when we looked at the two assay techniques and we looked at the advantages, disadvantages of each technique, we see that in the colorimetric method using the Latchett, there's a lag time between determination of ammonia and the stopping of the incubation. So we have to have a really good method of stopping that reaction to get reliable enzyme kinetic data. And we haven't come up with that method. So there could be some urea being converted even from the time that we pull it out of the incubator to the time it's run on the machine. It's really difficult to measure at near time zero to get initial reaction rates with this. So measurements are only really feasible in hours and not minutes. And the only thing that we can be measured with this method is ammonia, and that's the product of reaction. Whereas if we go down to the spectroscopy method, it's more simplistic. We don't need to make up chemical reagents. It's a one-to-one mixture. It's pretty straightforward. We can measure both urea and carbonate. There are urea peaks from the amide groups. And we can measure bicarbonate in real time. We don't have to stop the reaction. We just actually have to click a mouse, and it scans the sample again. And reactions can be measured at time zero as well as in minute intervals from 0 to 20, or you can carry it out to even days. We can come back and sample that assay again and again as long as we don't stop the reaction. The conclusions of my study are that, one, we can extract active enzyme from both corn and soybeans. However, in both assay methods, there looks like there is a difference between urease extracted from corn residue compared to urease extracted from soybean residue. And this difference probably needs to be looked in more depth at, and that's what we plan to do here in the coming months. The 50 millimolar sodium phosphate solution looks like it's going to be the best extracting solution for us because the pH is relatively constant between both residue types, and that allows us to compare the urease activities of these residues. The FTIR method, this is in Dr. Barone's lab, but we get measurements in real time. We don't have to stop the reaction. We don't have to mess with chemicals. It's less time for our lab undergrads and for me to be in working with chemicals in the lab and chemical resources. But the best thing is we can measure urea and bicarbonate using this method. Just some future research considerations. Like I said, we need to really look at this corn-soybean thing, what we have data for, and just look at that difference to see if that's a true difference and if there's something going on there, if it's just the lack of urease, the lower amount of urease in the corn residue compared to soybean residue. And we're going to try to purify that to get the concentration of urease up. And then if there is differences here, we need to look at other types of residues. I know vetch is used in Virginia on some fields, crimson clover, and look at these different types of residues that are used in no-till production to see if that's going to differ from species to species and if we need to use different management practices when applying these urea-based fertilizers. And that comes to my last, if these residues do differ in terms of urease activity, what kind of end management tactics are we going to need to alter? Are we going to use less urease inhibitors on granular urea that's surface applied on corn? Maybe up the concentration of, say, the inhibitor NVPT when you're applying nitrogen to soybean residue, or just go to injection where we're injecting this below these residues, and that's a tactic already used to minimize ammonia volatilization losses in the field. And I'd just like to thank you for your time, and I'll take any questions at this time. Yes. It could be coming from microorganisms. That's something that we're not differentiating. We're looking at the full, just the urease component of the plant material and the microbial organisms. Now, as this residue is in the field a little bit longer, like I said, we took it from harvest, the microbial population is going to build up on it and start to decay it. So we're not looking at a specific plant urease, just the urease complex of that residue. Yes.
The possibility of like when you collected your residue, you collected that from a single field, or did you replicate that across different fields or cultivars?
We did one cultivar from one field on the residue. And I think this was Pioneer 1184, the variety, and it was fertilized with 100 pounds of nitrogen. And the soybean was Glen.
Okay.
But yeah, it's just one variety. And we don't know if these things change from cultivar to cultivar, from variety to variety of these species either. And that's something that could be looked at with this. And so yeah, this is just what we had, and we figured the less variation we introduce, then the we less of confounding or conflicting results. So. Yes, ma'am.
In light of these results, have you looked at any data in the literature published already with the use of urease inhibitors and where they're effective and not effective? You know, sometimes we see responses and not.
Mm-hmm.
And tried to track that back to what the previous crop was.
I've looked at some data that's looked at rotation effects, like continuous corn and urease activity from different rotations. And typically the more diverse rotations have higher urease activity, and as well as microbial activity. So I don't know if that's a result of the microbial populations that are, that can convert urea to ammonia, or from the urease source of the plant. But yeah, typically the more diverse, and if you have legumes in the rotation, they tend to have more urease, more protein anyway, in them than non-legumes. So that's in the literature. I mean, that's documented. So I expected to get urease activity from soybean. I didn't know if we were going to get it or not get it from corn. So.
Okay, thanks, Hunter.
Thank you.